Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com coming to you on the 16th of December 2011 here in Japan. And today I'm honored to be joined on the line from the United States by Rick Rozoff of Stop NATO International at rickrozoff.wordpress.com. So, Rick, it's great to have you back on the program today. Thank you for taking the time to join us.
It's good to be back on the program. Thanks for inviting me.
All right. Well, today I'd like to talk about Kyrgyzstan, which is a geostrategically important state in Central Asia that not a lot of people know a lot about, but has been of great importance to NATO and to the U.S. over the past 10 years of occupation in Afghanistan. So perhaps for listeners and viewers out there who don't know the history of this relationship between the U.S. and Kyrgyzstan, perhaps you can give us a bit of an overview of just why this is a strategically important area.
Well, because of its location in the first place, it borders three of the other four former Soviet Central Asian republics, now independent nations. Those are Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan. It also borders China on the northwestern border of China. Since the beginning of so-called Operation Enduring Freedom and the U.S. and NATO moving into Afghanistan, over 10 years ago, the longest war, of course, in the history of Afghanistan, as well as the longest in the history of the United States, Kyrgyzstan has been the central transit nation for over a decade-long war. The former air base at Manas in Kyrgyzstan, for the last couple of years has been referred to as the transit center in Manas. The change in name is to try to de-emphasize its military role. But as of early last year, that is 2010, U.S. military officials were talking about as many as 50,000 U.S. and NATO troops transiting through the Manas base each month. That is 600,000 troops per year. There may be some double counting with them coming in and out, but nevertheless, this was part of an expansion of U.S. and NATO military hardware and personnel, not only in South Asia and Afghanistan and Pakistan, but in Central Asia. For example, German military forces still occupy a base in Uzbekistan at Termez. French warplanes were stationed near Dushanbe in Tajikistan. So the entire area has become a base of operations for U.S. and NATO military forces. We have to recall that the invasion of Afghanistan on October 7th, 2001, came within only a few months of the founding of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is a regional security, trade, and energy and transit alliance of Russia, China, and actually to this day, the four Central Asian republics I mentioned, that is all except for Turkmenistan, so Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, it is critically important in terms of its location.
It certainly is, and as I understand, the Manas airbase or transit facility or whatever they want to call it these days has been a point of contention with the Kyrgyzstani local people for a long time. Can you tell us about some of the tensions that this base and the U.S. operations have caused there?
Amongst other matters, the U.S. military has been dumping fuel near and in the air, near the base, so it's an environmental and health hazard to local residents. It's also been, a cause of various scandals that contracting and so forth, where bribery has been a major issue. This has been a factor, I don't think the determining one, but it's been a factor in the so-called Tulip Revolution of 2005 and then its follow-up 2 years later, or 2 years ago, rather. That is, heads of state and other government officials were accused of basically having their palms greased for fuel contracts and other matters pertaining to the base. But also, about 3 years ago, Russia, which also has a small military contingent in Kyrgyzstan, so you see Russia and the United States with military forces in the same country. That's the only place in the world where that occurs, of course. But that Russia had offered a fairly substantial economic assistance package to the government of Kiev, who was overthrown in the second round of the Tulip Revolution. In a sense, I suppose, to buy favor with them and maybe ease the United States and NATO out of the Manas Transit Center. However, shortly thereafter, the U.S. simply raised the bid and outbid Russia, and the military operations at the transit center in Manas have continued unimpeded since.
There have been accusations about Manas being a facility for shipping drugs out of Afghanistan. Do you know anything about those accusations, where they're coming from, or what basis they might have?
The charges have been rife, and they've existed for several years, and they're probably difficult to authenticate or verify. But I think it's a safe assumption that the new international narcotics network, we have to recall that just 2 days ago, the head of the Russian Anti-Drug Bureau, Viktor Ivanov, reiterated the fact that Kosovo in the South Balkans is a major transit center for narcotics moving into Europe. And there's been, I don't know how well one can document these matters, but there's been a pretty persuasive argument that heroin and refined opium from Afghanistan is making its way, perhaps through the South Caucasus, Georgia in one case, into Kosovo, where also, by the way, in recent years, there have been reports that Kosovo is the point of entry for cocaine and marijuana coming from Colombia, which is another U.S. military client state, where 2 years ago in September, the United States obtained the right to move into seven new military bases. Which, when actualized, will be the first permanent U.S. military bases in South America. So we see a nexus evolving of narcotic trafficking from South Asia, the Balkans, South America, and it follows, in fact, wherever the U.S. and NATO go.
Well, as I understand it, the Manas airbase issue has been a, sort of a political football in Kyrgyzstan for quite a while now, and we've heard rustlings and rumors about the U.S. being kicked out for years now, and now with the newly elected president, Atambayev, again, we hear once again that the U.S. is going to be kicked out. What do you think about the years-long process of this political talk, and do you think that this might actually unfold as it's being put forward right now?
I'm with you, James, that we've been bitten too many times by these rumors to be overly optimistic about the recent ones, with the incoming president claiming he's going to close down the base. We have to keep in mind, of course, that the United States is claiming, NATO is claiming, that they're going to withdraw the bulk of their military forces within the next 3 years, that is by 2014. However, a leading German general assigned to NATO's International Security Assistance Force a few days ago mentioned that NATO will retain at least 15,000 troops in Afghanistan past 2014. That may be a conservative estimate. It would be intriguing, of course, if the incoming administration in Bishkek does, in fact, live up to that pledge and closes down the transit center at Manas. On the heels of Pakistan, after the deadly raid by NATO aircraft on November 26, that killed at least 24 of their soldiers, has blockaded essentially NATO supplies coming into Afghanistan. And as there have been soundings from Russia that with the increasingly aggressive and dangerous moves by the U.S. and NATO with their so-called missile shield, that is their interceptor missile, potentially first strike system they'll be installing in Eastern Europe, in the Caucasus eventually, in the Black Sea and in Turkey with the radar installation, that Russia itself might look at halting what's called the Northern Distribution Network for non-lethal supplies going into the U.S. and NATO troops in Afghanistan. Should the three of these occur more or less simultaneously, that is, Pakistan blocking the shipment of NATO supplies into Afghanistan, with Russia doing the same, and Kyrgyzstan closing down the Manas transit center, a situation may come into existence that one Pakistani analyst a couple of weeks ago referred to as a Vietnam-style retreat. I think maybe an earlier Indochinese allusion, that of Dien Bien Phu in 1954 with the French, might be in order. That is, you might have upward of 130,000, 140,000 U.S. and NATO troops trapped in Afghanistan without being able to be resupplied, or in the case of Kyrgyzstan, even being able to get out.
What carrots and or sticks do you think the U.S. has to deploy in their negotiations with Kyrgyzstan at this point, or do you think they've spent all their political capital?
With the budgetary crisis in the United States, I would say ordinarily or otherwise, that Washington has less largesse or less bribery money to shower on the new Kyrgyz president. However, as we know, just yesterday, the U.S. Congress voted on the National Defense Authorization Act, which will budget $662 billion for the Pentagon next year. That'll be added on to, I'm sure, with certain contingency additions. So when it comes to military at home or abroad, particularly abroad, the U.S. doesn't stint any effort or spare any expense. So it's still entirely possible that Washington, the State Department, under the guise of so-called soft power, may slip suitcases full of U.S. dollars into Bishkek for that purpose. One can only speculate. One can also hope that finally the Kyrgyz administration will live up to its vow and evict U.S. NATO forces. You know, by the way, there are 1,000 U.S. military personnel assigned on an ongoing basis at the transit center at Manas. So it's a permanent U.S. Military base in a country that borders China and is not terribly far from Russia.
Indeed. Well, let's shift our focus just a little bit to something that you mentioned just a little bit ago. You talked about the Pakistani air raid by NATO forces last month that it resulted in the death of 26 Pakistani military personnel and the shutting of Pakistan's borders to NATO's supply chain, which is a very, very important move in the area and a very troubling sign for what has been a very rocky relationship in recent years. And when coupled with other things that are going on in the broader region, including, of course, the downing of the drone in Iran recently, and also the moves towards war with Syria, or at least some sort of military intervention, which seems more and more likely. What is your overall take on what is happening here, and do you think we are moving towards some sort of World War III type scenario?
If I had to tell you my visceral feeling about it, and I'm somebody who was old enough to remember the Cuban Missile Crisis as well as the war in Indochina, the forces are in place, and I'm talking about U.S. in the first instance, but allied, NATO, military allies in the Persian Gulf, the rapid consolidation of what has been referred to accurately enough as an Asian NATO. There are stories in today's press, for example, that South Korea and Australia are consolidating their military ties. Japan and Australia are consolidating their military ties, and this comes almost immediately on the heels of President Barack Obama's visit to Australia, where he announced that up to 2,500 U.S. Marines are going to be stationed permanently at a military base, Darwin, in northern Australia, and so forth. So with all the markers being put in place on the grand chessboard, if you will, all indications are, and it's been remarked by several analysts recently, that the U.S. and its Western allies and the Eastern allies have moved from the broader Middle East war front of the past decade and to picking off smaller non-aligned or independent countries on the periphery over the last 12 years, of course, Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, now Syria, I'm quite certain you're correct, is already in the process of suffering a similar fate. That the U.S. and its allies have gone from picking off local, small, essentially defenseless nations to moving towards large, strategically important countries. Those three countries, of course, are Iran, China, and Russia.
Well, obviously, you're keeping tabs of what's going on in the various theaters at Stop NATO International and are doing quite a yeoman's effort at just keeping track of all of these different things. And there is so much going on. But taking a look at the broader situation, what do you think of the anti-war movement as it exists right now? Do you think there even really is much of an anti-war movement in North America at this point?
There are isolated pockets of very dedicated and heroic individuals who are working, and to use your term, doing yeoman service in the cause of publicizing and exposing much of what we've been speaking about. I fear, however, that in the United States, in the West, in the world, there is not a coordinated anti-war movement of the sort that we saw, say, during the Vietnam War in the 60s and early 70s. Anything comparable to, for example, the Stockholm Peace Appeal against nuclear weapons in the early 1950s. It is something on exactly the order of the initiatives I just mentioned that is required and has been required for some period of time. I am deeply disturbed that people who in the past realized the importance of stopping military aggression abroad seem to have placed that issue very low on the list of their priorities. and failed to see that I just mentioned a $662 billion Pentagon war budget for next year. Anyone in the United States that is concerned about funding for education, for healthcare, for infrastructural repair, for affordable housing, for whatever issues people are concerned about, that's $662 billion, and that's down from an estimated $729 billion this year. This year's Pentagon budget represents roughly $2,400 every man, woman, and child in the United States. Next year's projected budget, even at its base of $662 billion, represents $2,200 for each of the 300 million citizens of the United States. That, if for no other reason, if people are not politically or morally offended by the fact that the U.S. is, through drone attacks, for example, killing people in six countries currently, or recently and currently, or that we are inching dangerously closer to a military confrontation with countries like Iran and China and Russia, then the very fact that money that should be available for human needs is being expended for wars abroad ought to evoke a lot more notice and opposition than it clearly does.
Well, then, having said that, are you optimistic that some sort of effective anti-war movement will be able to arise in time to stop what seems to be the inevitable progress towards war in these different theaters? Or do you think that that we are simply headed for these more military conflicts?
You know, I'm only suggesting possibilities. I'm looking at patterns that are emerging and, you know, building upon past military aggression over the last 12 years and what it tends to portend, you know, for what we can expect in the present and the imminent future. Is there time to put together a mass anti-war movement that can stop a military action? No, there is not, James. And this has been, in many cases, this responsibility to do so has not been lived up to. It's been abdication of responsibility, a forfeiting of that role. That's not to say that every effort should not be extended, you know, immediately and in an ongoing manner to do as much as can be done. But if the momentum, for example, that existed in the autumn and winter of 2003 before the invasion of Iraq had been built upon, extended, consolidated, then I seriously doubt that the escalation of U.S. troops in Afghanistan over the last 2 years, and certainly the criminal war against Libya earlier this year, would have been as easy for the U.S. and NATO to have perpetrated as they were.
Well, then, if people are interested in supporting your efforts at Stop NATO, what can they do to support you?
We, of course, are a not-for-profit organization. We neither solicit nor accept funds. But I would encourage people, of course, to subscribe to the email list. Stop NATO has a daily digest where you can get one email a day with fairly comprehensive news items from news sources around the world about topics around the world. There's also the website Stop NATO. Google search will bring both of them up pretty easily. Google search with my name, Rozoff, will certainly do so. First of all, we have to be informed. Second of all, we have to pass on the information. Third, you know, I'm speaking to you, of course, from Chicago, where in May, NATO is holding its summit. And it's one that will build upon the so-called strategic concept that was adopted at the last summit in Lisbon, Portugal, a year ago last month. And it includes, most saliently perhaps, the consolidation of a so-called missile shield in not only Europe, but in the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, ultimately the South Caucasus, linking up with India. If, you know, a recent overture by the U.S. Permanent Representative to NATO, Ivo Dalder, is realized, which in turn, of course, will connect with the Eastern Missile Shield with nations like Australia, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan. The missile shield issue is of primary importance. The celebration by NATO of the seven-month bombing onslaught against Libya and the murder of its head of state as a great victory that serves as a template or a prototype for similar maneuvers, perhaps in Syria, as you alluded to, and who knows where else in the world. But the fact that NATO has now anointed itself a global military intervention force is going to be, I believe, enshrined at the summit in Chicago. So all efforts, I believe, have to be focused at this point at, you know, protest and other activities leading up to and for the NATO summit in Chicago in May.
All right, Rick Rozoff, Stop NATO International, rickrozoff.wordpress.com. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Yeah, thank you.